Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Can you describe what you see in front of us?
You know, a lot of concrete with two very large guns standing atop them.
What does it look like from the other side?
It looks like nothing. The designers and planners of this fortification and the other forts at Fort Warden and Fort Flagler wanted them to be hidden from enemy vessels trying to enter the Puget Sound. You know, the three of them in combination form this kind of triangle, which has come to be called the Triangle of Fire.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And I went out recently to Fort Casey on Whidbey Island with a guy named Sam Watipka. He works for the state parks, and he explained how these three massive forts were built in the 1890s to protect Puget Sound from invading ships. We made our way up through cramped concrete rooms where they used to store these 600-pound metal shells. Sam compared them to huge beer kegs flung at 1,500 miles per hour.
So we're emerging from...
The bowels, yes.
To, well, gosh, how would you describe what we're standing near?
It's really an impressive sight. I think, you know, it's certainly the main attraction at Fort Casey. This is one of two 10-inch guns that we have, 10-inch disappearing guns, I should say. And they're the only two of their type left in the entire world. This was kind of one of the central innovations of coast defense fortifications from this period, is that, you know, they would be hidden from view. They weren't always up. The one we're looking at is in the up position. But, you know, mostly they were held in the down position behind the walls of the fort. And, you know, they would raise and fire, and the recoil pushed the gun back down into the down position. And, you know, if you were sitting in a ship out in the water, you would be looking at a wall of earth.
And then from the ship's point of view, this gun pops up, lobs one of those 600-pound beer kegs at you, and then disappears before you can fire back.
That was the theory.
Is it okay if I climb up there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We've got ladders for that.
It feels like I shouldn't be allowed to do this, but I'm going to take your word for it.
I'll come up the other side.
Okay. Oh, wow. So you could see they really have literally a commanding view of the inlet. I'm going to give this a little knock. It might not make any noise at all, but here we go. Yeah, it's so solid. It's not like it gives a little ring when you tap on the barrel of this massive gun. It just sounds like you're tapping on a mountain.
You could go out there and take a look inside of it, too.
Oh, really?
That actually might be worth doing.
Oh, cool. So I'm just going to stick my mic in this thing.
Hello?
How many battles were fought here at Fort Casey?
Zero.
Why not?
Well, you know, technology just kept advancing very rapidly, in fact. You know, when these were built, they didn't really give much thought to the idea that, you know, much more powerful guns could eventually be mounted to and accurately fired from ships. In 1903, the Wright brothers had their first successful test flight. You know, by World War I, those were being used in battle. It takes a long time to build something like this. I mean, it really took, you know, a good decade of labor before all three forts were fully complete. And by that point, you know, the situation in the world had really changed a lot.
The Triangle of Fire was built to protect against threats like the Spanish Armada. By World War I, the forts were brand new and already white elephants.
What we've arrived at is really this story of technology and how change, you know, can happen very rapidly and suddenly make huge investments obsolete.
Well, not completely obsolete. Those forts are all parks now. Kids scramble around the darkened bunkers in what Sam Watipka calls the state's biggest play structures. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is playing defense, stories of protecting our turf. You might think of boxing as an aggressive sport, all about going hard after your opponent. But it's at least as much about defense, avoiding punches, guarding your chin, protecting and hiding your vulnerabilities. This next story is about a fighter with a weakness, but it wasn't one that showed itself in the ring. Eloy Perez was a star in his hometown in Thurston County. He was a gifted athlete, yes, but he was also just a magnetic person. And between his charisma and his meteoric rise, it was easy to overlook the chinks in his armor. Sound Effects' Posey Gruner brings us his story, told by the people closest to him.
Emma Perez stands in a room in her parents' house, holding a pair of boxing gloves that once belonged to her brother.
These are a pair of his first boxing gloves. And you can just feel how much he used them. These hit grown men.
Eloy Perez grew up in Rainier and Rochester, neighboring small towns south of Olympia, Washington.
My name is Eloy Perez. I'm 19 years old. I'm a professional boxer, turned pro last June.
He had a chance to become big.
My all-time goal is just to be remembered.
My all-time goal, he said, is to be remembered. That audio was collected by Tony Overman, a photojournalist for The Olympian. Tony first heard about Eloy back in 2005.
My wife actually at the time told me about this high school kid that was fighting a professional boxer and said, you got to do a story about this kid.
It was the beginning of a years-long relationship, one that became a true friendship. And it started with what the hometown crowd called the legend of Eloy Perez.
His legend is always going to start with the story of him as a high school senior on Friday night rushing for 245 yards and four touchdowns, and the next night winning his first professional fight.
He seemed destined for greatness.
He told me, you know, I'm supposed to be world champion in a year. That's what they tell me.
After Eloy won that first fight at his hometown casino, he went on to bigger rings. Eloy graduated high school and moved to California, hooked up with a crew of trainers and managers. He signed a deal with Oscar De La Hoya's promotion company, Golden Boy. And he kept on winning. 8 wins. 9 wins. He fought in even bigger rings. His 13th win was a knockout. In the fall of 2008, 2 years after he graduated, Eloy came back home for a visit. Tony was there, too, to photograph a football game.
And I showed up for the game, and I walked in, and up against the fence was Eloy. And he was surrounded by all of his friends. And he had this big smile, and he's laughing. I mean, this is, you know, this local hero, undefeated professional boxer, back home again for one of the first times. And he looked through the crowd, and he saw me, made eye contact with me, and his face lit up. He was already smiling. And when he saw me, his smile got bigger. Just because I was there. I mean, that's got to make you feel good. And that's the way he was. He was that way with everybody.
During that visit, they agreed that Tony would document Eloy's career.
I said, I don't ever want to lose contact with you. And I never did.
The rings kept getting bigger. 15, 20, 23 wins. He wasn't just winning. He was undefeated.
The second story I wrote about him, I said he carries himself with the confidence of a 24-year-old that it's never lost. And he was, I mean, literally everything he did, he thought he was going to succeed and he was going to get away. Nothing was going to go wrong for him because everything had gone right for him.
But there was one opponent waiting in the wings, one that was very, very hard to beat.
One of the biggest problems for Eloy, even as a professional boxer, was that he was an unregistered, undocumented alien.
Yo me vine cuando mi hijo tenía año tres meses.
That's Eloy's mother, Digna. They crossed the border together when Eloy was just a toddler. Eloy's father, Eloy Sr., had gone first. But at the time, Digna was pregnant, and in a decision that would have really big consequences for Eloy, she decided to stay in Mexico until after he was born. Eloy's little sister, Emma, was born a few years later, after the family had settled in Washington State.
He would tell me he was envious of me that I was born in the United States and he wasn't.
But if Eloy didn't have status, he at least had talent.
He knew he didn't have any outlook. If he wasn't going to fight, he would never be able to get a job here. And if he did, it would be a hard working under the table job.
He saw boxing as a way to earn some money for his parents, to make a name for his hometown, to be somebody.
gentlemen, good evening and welcome to...
Then, in 2012, Eloy got his big chance.
This is for the WBO Junior Lightweight Championship of the World.
A fight to be the world champion. Broadcast live on HBO. Corner,
Adrian, the problem...
Adrian Broner was a three different weight class world champion. Was really the Floyd Mayweather prototype is what they said about him. He was phenomenal.
It did not go well.
I knew he was losing right from the beginning. You could tell he was going to lose the fight. He didn't have the power. Now, granted, Broner was a really great defensive fighter, but he was bigger than Eloy. He was stronger than Eloy, and Eloy couldn't hurt him.
In round four, 20 minutes into the fight, Eloy's defenses failed him.
Broner hit him and it hurt. And he went to duck down to duck out. And when he ducked down, Broner punched him in the back of the head.
Good straight right hand and down goes Perez.
And then Eloy tried to get up and stumbled. And then he tried to get up again and stumbled into the ropes and fell.
It was a knockout. After the fight was over, the trouble started immediately. Eloy failed his post-fight drug test for cocaine.
Growing up, you know, I knew, you know, he did drugs, but he was smart with it. And then it came to a point when he was like, he wanted to get caught.
Eloy's managers and promoters released him from his contracts. And that's when Eloy's shadow side really started to come out.
He had a lot of demons.
He came home to Washington, got a DUI, landed on the radar of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
And he called me and he was like, hey, I feel like I'm being watched. I was like, okay. I was like, I think it's just the drugs, you know. He was like, no, I really feel like I'm being watched.
He was. ICE picked him up and brought him to the Northwest Detention Center near Tacoma.
And he was there for over a year. And, you know, we got a lawyer. We put our whole life savings into the lawyer. And
it didn't work. The judge offered Eloy a way out of there. Voluntary deportation. Eloy signed the papers, and within a week, he was in Tijuana.
The problem with Eloy going to Tijuana was that he'd never lived there. He didn't know Mexico. He didn't speak the language.
It wasn't all bad. He met a girl, Janelle Herrera, and she saw that he needed taken care of.
He just seemed kind of like, as I would say, a lost puppy.
Janelle saw his best sides, the caring side, the goofy side. She helped Eloy get a job at a call center.
I told him, you know what, you have a great personality. You need to talk to people. And nobody likes telemarketing. But Eloy had, he was just great at it, honestly.
They had good times. But Janelle worried about him. Eloy liked to hang out in rough neighborhoods. He trusted the wrong people. And he liked to tell people that he used to be a pro boxer. She told him not to do that. Janelle was worried that one day Eloy would cross the wrong person, someone who knew that they would lose in a fist fight.
You know, you being mad at this person, you can't beat him up. I mean, somebody would be like, you know what, I'm gonna just shoot him.
It was a reasonable fear.
Tijuana averages almost 7 murders a day. Murders. Every day.
In early October of 2019, Eloy went missing. Janelle checked the hospitals, and then the jails, and then the morgue. Then she called Eloy's sister, Emma.
I get a phone call from Janelle. She was like, Emma, they killed him. And at this point, my mom came out, and she was like, and she knew. She just knew.
Yo la tiré y me tiré en el suelo. ¿Qué le pasó a mi hijo? ¿Qué le pasó a mi hijo?
What happened to my son? What happened to my son? Emma and Tony went down to Tijuana.
There's one morgue in the entire city of Tijuana that averages 7 murders a day, and there's no computers and no refrigeration. And they make you go and do all the paperwork by hand and stand in line all day, and you get to end the day by going in and looking at your dead loved one, and the people would come out wailing and crying and being hugged, and they'd walk down the stairs in front of all of these other people who were sitting waiting for their turn to go in and do that.
and then it's your turn.
They showed Emma a body on a stretcher. It was him.
I just fell. And it was hollering and why? That should not have been him.
The police report said that Eloy was brought to a hill overlooking Tijuana and shot execution style. That's probably all they'll ever know.
In reality, murders in Tijuana don't get solved.
Before they left Tijuana, they organized a small memorial for Eloy. Tony remembers meeting Eloy's co-workers, fellow telemarketers from the call center.
At one point, I said, how come you guys all speak such good English? And they said, because we all used to live in the States. We all got deported. One guy said, I'm from El Salvador. I'm not even from here, and they deported me to Mexico. And he then turned and he pointed at Eloy's coffin, and he said, I could give you 20 stories exactly like this.
Eloy's ashes came back to the United States. They sit on a shelf at his parents' house in Rochester, in a little bedroom dedicated to him. The walls are painted blue, his favorite color, and they're covered with pictures of Eloy and newspaper clippings. His boxing shorts are there. There's a championship belt, some shoes, those gloves. It's hard for Emma to be in the room. She looks at the clippings and the memorabilia and the microphone that I'm holding up to her face. I ask her, what are you thinking?
He's really not here anymore. And he always said he wanted to be remembered. And it's amazing that people just want to hear about him. Because, you know, from all the bad, he was still a really good person.
And that is the end of the legend of Eloy Perez.
That story from Sound Effects Posey Gruner. You can see some of Tony Overman's photos of Eloy on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is playing defense. Going into his freshman year at the University of Washington back in 2001, Lowell Mengesha felt like he was prepared. For high school, Lowell went to Rainier Beach in South Seattle. He was an honors student, he ran cross country, and he was part of a student leadership group.
I was really involved and ambitious.
Lowell's family's from Ethiopia, and at Rainier Beach, there were a lot of students who looked like him. But his confidence took a hit after taking UW's math placement test.
Everybody has to take that placement test going into UW, and it places you into, you know, pre-calculus or calculus or algebra, whatever. Then I actually placed into a no-credit math class, Math 98. That was like the first blow in college, like realizing that now, even though everybody kind of knew I was smart in my high school, that just didn't matter anymore.
Lowell didn't settle for taking remedial math. He found free tutoring, took the test again, and got into a higher level math course. But the realization that succeeding in high school still didn't prepare him for UW dovetailed with another new reality. He was often one of the only black students in his classes. That came with obstacles, large and small, to his success. Lowell says he had to armor himself against those setbacks. Later, he'd document his solutions and workarounds in his book, The Only Black Student, published in 2009. The people Lowell wants to reach are students like 19-year-old Royce Kelly.
I am a 6'3", 180-pound, light-skinned man with long hair. I'm black and white. This is what I am, and I'm proud of what I am.
Royce graduated from Rainier Beach last June. He's attending community college in Seattle, and he hopes to transfer to Louisiana State University. Royce and Lowell sat down to talk about what it's like to navigate mostly white institutions.
The reason I wrote The Only Black Student was because I was an upperclassman, and I was meeting students like you. it felt like I was meeting smart people who were dropping out. It was always about something outside of the classroom. Like they were short on rent or short on their dorm, you know, dorm room payment, and they didn't know that they could just ask like a counselor if they knew of any scholarships or emergency financial aid. It just always seemed like there was this game that was being played that people just didn't understand how to navigate. And that's what I felt like I was always much better at that than I was in the actual classroom. So let's move 2 years into the future, and you just finished up at South Seattle, which is a very diverse space, smaller classes. You've gotten to know people. There's people who kind of look like you. There's people who have similar backgrounds. And then you're going to LSU, which is more homogenous. What concerns do you have or might have about that transition?
That I'll have to, like, code switch. So I'm half white, so I have white family. And I'm very familiar with how they speak to people and how they interact with other people. So when I'm talking to certain people, I'll take the bass out of my voice. If I'm talking to somebody that I feel like can affect what I'm doing, I'm usually more like submissive and want to avoid conflict with that person. I guess I kind of just like, I change up how I talk and then how I act in certain ways. Because, I mean, I'm very animated and I move around a lot like I'm doing now. Nobody can see me besides you guys, but I'm moving right. My hands. And it's just, yeah, I'm a very animated person. When I'm talking to certain people, I sort of just stop what I'm doing.
Be more reserved.
And be more reserved, yeah. And I'm just, that's not who I actually am.
I don't code switch anymore. I'm like... who I am as much as I can be.
When did you stop code switching so much?
I think, you know, luckily I do live in Oakland, California now, and I feel like it's just a lot easier to be more of yourself there because we have so many examples of people that are successful who speak in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the Northwest is probably a little more conservative around that type of identity. Like if I lived back in Seattle and I worked corporate or government or tech here, I feel like I probably would have to make some of those sacrifices, and I wouldn't want to do that at this stage because I love who I am and I want to be as true to that as possible. Well, with my book, The Only Black Student, so much is kind of like arming yourself and how you navigate. And it sounds like you're already thoughtful about what are certain ways that you're perceived and how you have to arm yourself. When you are in college and you know you have long hair and it's you know, people are gonna ask to touch your hair a lot, so and I know you've already dealt with that, but you're gonna be in spaces where people don't look like you who are asking to touch your hair, and it's gonna, you know, it's a judgment call on your end, you know. But I was very uncomfortable with it, and sometimes I'd be playful and other times I'd be like, no, you know, it's because I used to have long hair. Yeah, so that, but it's going to happen. People, again, are going to be in your space and they're going to try to take away your agency of your own space, your own body over and over again. So you got to look out for yourself. Being profiled happened multiple times on campus. I had a friend that, I mean, this one, we were so oblivious to how it could be perceived, but he locked his keys in his car, and I went upstairs to my dorm to get him a coat hanger, and he's driving a hoopty. And a hoopty is a car that is low cost, typically has like rims on it, and is like either a Cadillac or let's say a 1999 music video type of car. But anyways, right? So he's the only person on campus that would have this car. Multiple people call the cops on us. So I think three cop cars pull up on us, and we're still not getting what's happening, you know. We're like trying to get into his car, and we were the threat, you know. So eventually they realize that we're trying to get into his car, and one of the officers helps us get in. But I was like, oh, you know, this is another example of me understanding that the students on campus didn't really see me as like a fellow student.
I would feel like, it's just like, all right, man. But at the end of that, it's still my car. So I'm just, I'd still be pretty calm about it, though.
We don't get to be emotionally expressive. So knowing that even the advocacy of against a accusation, we have to be in control, which is, it's really wild that we have to be in control when dealing with an authoritative figure like a police officer, which is not, I mean, we're civilians. It's not our job.
Yeah.
That's like, I think, one part of understanding how to navigate this country. The second part is then speaking up for yourself in a way that does not get you harmed.
Mm-hmm.
So you already know the, kind of the neutralizing the situation. You're like, oh, you know what? The stakes are not that big here. This is not a big deal. So in the grand scheme of things, which really is, that shows just how self-aware you are. And the other part is saying to yourself, like, you're going to fight for every single one of these little attacks on you.
Because
that's what I do now. It doesn't matter how small it is, because you need to always be practicing advocacy. You need to always practice speaking up for yourself. It's, you know, always practice speaking up for other people. And every time you do that, you feel just a bit better. One way that I would get professors to see me in the classroom, I would often just ask a professor if they could repeat themselves, if they said something like a lower tone that nobody else could hear, because I just wanted to hear my voice in a class of 400 people. Hearing your voice in these classes is some form of feeling like you've been acknowledged and accepted. What do you want to do, Royce?
I want to major in kinesiology.
Okay.
And since I was an athlete, my trainer, like the dude that took care of us when we got hurt, I always thought that job was pretty cool.
Right.
Because it's like, I like helping people, so.
The people that we look for, like the mentors that I talked about, we can often find them in a lot of different places. For me, at the University of Washington, there was a black chemistry professor, and just even seeing him on campus really made me understand that it was possible to be in this realm and be in this world. When you see somebody who looks like you, who is successful in a space that you're curious about, it makes it seem much more tangible and real.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Lul Mangesha is an author, a filmmaker, and the founder of a startup in Oakland, California. Royce Kelly is a recent graduate of the International Baccalaureate program at Seattle's Rainier Beach High School. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I call this next story How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Viruses. Our theme today is playing defense, but this isn't a story about vaccines or washing your hands or something. This is about how sometimes viruses are on your side. You know viruses, the little guys that give you the flu or Ebola or polio. Well, it turns out that viruses might actually be able to help you fight infections. And while we're at it, they may be the reason that you didn't hatch from an egg. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's start with a definition.
Viruses are parasites that are able to commandeer host cells in order to reproduce themselves more successfully.
This is Harmeet Malik. He heads up a lab at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center focused on evolutionary biology. Malik says a virus has three basic parts: the genetic material, or software, a hard protein shell around it, and a kind of envelope around that, which lets it interact with other stuff. And over the eons, those interactions have loomed really, really large. So, big picture question, what kind of a role overall would you say that viruses have played in driving evolution and creating basically the world we live in now?
I think that's a really excellent question. And it turns out that even if you look in a very short window of 50 million years of evolution, we have many, many examples of viral genes that have really shaped fundamental features of our biology, from reproduction to immune protection, as well as even neuronal transmission. So things that we consider are bona fide human genes and human biological processes actually owe their roots to something that came from a virus.
So how exactly do viruses weasel their way into our biology? Well, when a type of virus called a retrovirus enters a cell, it makes a genetic imprint or copy of itself and literally inserts it into our DNA. If that cell happens to form a sperm or an egg, the viral DNA then gets inherited by future generations.
We are now also basically passing on this genetic legacy of this retrovirus that inserted itself into our DNA.
Wow. And so that adds up over time. And so how much of that stuff is there in our genome that we all carry around with us?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. It turns out that within our own genome, we find at least 100,000 such imprints that have been made by different viruses over the course of the last 50 million years of evolution. And that in total makes up about 8% of our DNA.
8% of our human DNA in every cell in your body is of viral origin.
It's of viral, of recognizable viral origin. And that's an underestimate because there's even more that we can no longer recognize actually came from a virus.
So what does that enable you as a researcher trying to reconstruct the past? What does that let you do, the fact that you can then go in and discover all of this evidence of ancient infections?
So the best analogy I can make is that we are basically archaeologists. We are studying viruses that have not left a fossil record in the traditional sense, but they've left a fossil record in our own DNA. We are trying to reconstruct how viruses evolved over the course of millions of years of evolution. But what it also allows us to do is actually reconstruct how our own immune systems actually battled these viruses such that we came out ahead.
So do we have a sense then of how these, you know, infections repeated 100,000 times or many more than that, most likely, have changed the course of evolution for human beings?
Yeah, so our eye is really drawn to pieces of these dead viruses that have completely survived what should be a history of mutation, almost as if the host genome decided when this retrovirus landed in it that this is a valuable piece of information and that's what I'm going to use for some function that I did not have previously. And
so wait, let me just pause there for a second. So you're saying that the virus comes in, affects a, let's say, a person. It squirts a little bit of its DNA and it winds up in the genome. And eventually the human organism figures out some other use for it, repurposes it.
Now it's basically switched sides and it's now become a host gene where we're using these genes to be of use to our own biology.
What's an example of that?
So one really great example of that, which a lot of people have studied, is a gene called syncytin. This is the same gene that is actually deployed in one cell type in our body, which is the placental cell, which is what actually mediates nutrition transfer and immune defense of the developing fetus inside mom. So it turns out that our main sort of mechanism of biological reproduction, which is live birth, may owe its roots to insertion from a virus that landed on genome many millions of years ago.
Wow. So you're saying that the virus comes in, it has a gene that sort of dictates the creation of its own little shell, its own protective shell. That gets inserted into the human genome. The human organism says, hey, that's a really good shell. I'm going to use that. How about for, say, an embryo? So not only was that handy, you're saying that there's at least a good chance that that is like a key driver of the live birth phenomenon, the idea that you can have birth, give birth to live young rather than laying an egg.
Yeah, so each different mammalian lineage that does live birth, they have their own version of a syncytin gene, each of which is actually derived from their own version of an envelope from a retrovirus that happened to land in their progenitor many millions of years ago.
Wow. So over and over again, this same little drama has played out where a virus comes in looking to hijack a human cell, and then the human kind of does a little double reverse thing on it and then hijacks the viral DNA.
It's basically like evolutionary spoils of war, right? Like we're taking all of these viruses that are landing on our surface in our DNA and basically exploiting some of them that have actually value.
So there really is a lot about our humanness that is originally derived from a virus.
I think that's completely accurate to say, but it's not just humans. I think all animals owe some part of their basic biology to a co-evolutionary history of viruses.
So another player in this co-evolution is single-celled microorganisms, especially bacteria. And you've written a lot about evolutionary arms races between particularly viruses and bacteria. How does that impact human health, if at all?
This battle for survival has been going on for millennia between microorganisms and viruses that affect those microorganisms. As viruses like phage take over bacterial populations and then bacteria fight back.
A phage virus is a virus that attacks a bacteria.
That's right. But then for phage to survive, they need to mount counter defenses against these defense strategies.
So viruses are attacking bacteria. Bacteria are mounting defenses that then attack the viruses. The viruses are trying to outsmart that. Well, that all sounds like a fun little academic exercise that happens under a microscope. How does that impact, you know, the macro world?
In some cases, we can use viruses that actually attack pathogenic bacteria as a form of phage therapy. You know, even as we're getting into the age where bacteria are getting more and more resistance to most of the antibiotics we have to throw against them, we're discovering more and more reports of these bacteria that are basically resistant to any antibiotic known to man. We need to now think about other biological mechanisms by which we can go after these bacteria. And actually, viruses, these phage, are amazing at going out of that. So we're discovering more and more about the intricate mechanisms that phage have to infect bacteria, but also how effective those mechanisms can be in the face of failed antibiotic regimes.
Well, on that subject of more things to discover, what are some of the big unanswered questions that you are hoping, you know, you will either make some progress on or, you know, see answers to in the course of your career?
What we hope to discover is more surgical tools to treat bacterial infections. Right now, if you have a bacterial infection, you basically will take a broad spectrum antibiotic, which of course will probably quell the bacteria that is, you know, causing you distress, but it'll probably also get rid of a lot of very beneficial bacteria that you have. The really most amazing thing about these phage strategies is they are highly, highly specific. They're almost surgeons, whereas we are basically using a napalm bombing strategy to get rid of every bacteria. So what we're really hoping is that these phage strategies will allow us to discover these surgical tools to actually go in into a complex ecosystem and actually get rid of just the harmful bacteria without causing distress to the bacteria that we would really like to cause no harm to. But to be honest, I'm drawn to this because just this is what life is. This is our legacy, right? Like, it would not be possible for us to be who we are today without all of these things that have happened, some of which were beneficial and some of which you could argue were not so beneficial. And my, you know, 20-odd years in this business have taught me that there's always something unanticipated that actually blows what you know completely out of the water. And I'm really excited to discover what that next thing might be.
Harmeet Malik is a faculty member at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is playing defense. We're capping the show today with another story about a boxer, this one from a very different era. It's about a famous bout in 1938, one of the biggest of the period, that took place in what's now Seattle Center. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman brings us this classic underdog tale.
So it's the 1930s. Jobs are scarce. Money is tight. Like a lot of teenagers, Al Hostack is trying to figure out how he's going to make a living. His dad worked with glass, so there was that. But there was also Al's passion, boxing. It wasn't exactly a sure sell, especially at this one particular moment, right before Al's first real fight, when he sees who he's up against.
Somebody called the Northwest Wood Chopper or something like that.
That's John Oakes. He's a boxing historian and author in Seattle who has talked with Al over the years.
He saw this guy and he had a barrel chest, hair on his chest, and was not a particularly young man. He told his manager, Eddie, that guy's a man.
Al's manager says not to worry, just stick to what I've taught you. So Al laces up his gloves, gets into the ring, and next thing you know, bam, Al knocks the guy out. The match didn't go past the second round.
That was a big boost right there, that, you know, he didn't really have to worry about the superficial thing about how old a guy looked or how brawny he was. That Al himself had something.
And man, did Al have something. One knockout became 10, 10 became 20. The wins kept stacking up until, before you knew it, Al was one of the best middleweight fighters in the country.
And now, here comes Al Hostak, that clean-cut, young, 23-year-old kid from Seattle, Washington.
It's no wonder people called Al the Savage Sloth. He punched so hard that he'd sometimes break his own hands. And yet, he still had enough boyish charm for announcers to describe him like this.
Pink cheeks, nice, clean, young-looking boy, slim, husky, sort of waving his arms around.
But before Al was seen as any of those things, he was just a quiet kid from the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle. Here's John Oakes again.
He described it as a league of nations.
There were Slovaks, Poles, Germans. Al's own parents were Czech. He was the youngest of six siblings. And he looked up to one of his older brothers in particular. So when that brother started talking about Jack Dempsey, the world heavyweight champion at the time, it really stuck with Al.
And I guess he would shadow box and do all sorts of things, even though he'd never seen a fight, never seen Jack Dempsey fight. So that kind of laid the seed when he was about 5 years old.
You also don't have to talk much in boxing.
When he was a kid, he used to stammer and stutter.
Phil Hostak is Al's son. He says this stutter dogged Al throughout his childhood.
He was going to St. George's Catholic school there, and he was afraid that the nuns would call him to stand up in class and read a couple sentences out of a book. He couldn't do it.
Al didn't get any counseling back then, and the advice he'd often get was more or less just to get over it, which Oakes says probably didn't help.
Maybe his voice would quiver, maybe he'd shake, maybe he'd sweat, and that's really, an awfully uncomfortable experience.
So teaching or running for office or literally anything having to do with speech, as far as Al saw it, those types of jobs just weren't for him. Al was a doer, not a talker, so he gravitated towards things that didn't require a whole lot of explanation, like smacking around a ball at recess. Al felt at ease with sports, and it was just a matter of exposure when it came to boxing. One day, he and some friends were wandering around an alley, as kids were wont to do during the Depression, when they started messing around with a makeshift punching bag hanging from the roof of a barn.
And the neighbor came out of his door, and they all ran away, thinking that this neighbor was going to be mad at them. But he said, hey, wait, did you guys want to learn how to box? The kids, and this was during the summer, went back and started taking lessons. And by the end of the summer, Al was the only one that was going back.
Al gets to training, then fighting, mostly small local bouts. Al's son Phil says that after about 30 matches, people started to realize he was the real deal.
What do you think that was like for your dad? I mean, like, growing up with the stutter and not really being able to communicate, and then all of a sudden he found this thing that he was good at.
That gave him confidence. And when he started winning, then all the stuttering started to go away.
I want to say hello to all my friends in Seattle, and I'm very happy I won.
This is Al being interviewed after a fight in 1939.
Tired, Al. You did a quick job. You must have been in a hurry. I was in a hurry, all right.
The stutter seemed to disappear, although Al still dreaded public speaking, once going so far as to no-show for a scheduled interview. This fight, having difficulty speaking, it lasted well into Al's adult years, and it was way different from the fight that landed in his lap in 1938. By this time, Al was shaping up to be a serious contender for a world championship fight. His manager saw this, so did a local promoter. Al was ready, and it just so happened that the middleweight champion at the time lived 40 minutes away in Tacoma. So a date was set, 15 rounds against one of the most accomplished fighters of the time.
159, the middleweight champion of the world, Freddie Steele!
Freddie Steele was accomplished. He had confidence in his abilities, and many people would rank him as being in the top 10 of all middleweights.
Al and Steele ran in the same circle long before anyone thought to throw them in the ring. When he was younger, Al would scrounge together change to watch Steele fight, And as an amateur, Al fought on the undercard of Steele's matches, kind of like an opening act. So Al knew Steele's fighting style. He knew Steele would do this thing where he'd swipe away punches with his left hand, leaving his head unguarded for a fraction of a second. Along with his trainer, Al honed in on a way to exploit the habit.
And he'd been practicing it for years, and he only really had a split second in order to do this, because Steele was a smart fighter. So this had to be done just instantaneously.
It didn't just have to be fast. It had to be done under pressure. Everyone was watching Al. A stadium filled with gamblers, mobsters, and whoever managed to sneak past security. So the bell rings, the two walk to the center of the mat, and not even a minute goes by before Al gets his chance. Phil Hostack says his dad faked a punch, repositioned his weight, then threw a quick left hook at Steele's face.
That's how we knocked him down. He gets up and he goes after him again.
And Al knocks Steele down again and again and again.
And then the fourth time he got knocked down, he never got up.
Steele's manager slash mentor slash father figure died earlier that year. He was also reportedly getting over an injury. So maybe he wasn't at his best that night, but Al certainly was.
He had a flow to his movements and the speed, and everything came together. His mind and his body were one.
After Al wins, he gets a fat check for winning. And what does he go on to do? He didn't buy a fancy car or a mansion or a gold chain. He bought a gas station.
He would pump gas. He'd wash the windows. And, you know, he was a regular kind of guy.
In fact, Al's days as champion were brief. Injuries and the advent of World War II ended his career not long after it started. So when it comes to Al's legacy, the appeal isn't just about one short chapter on boxing. It has more to do with the ones bookending it and the story you get when you put them together. It's the story of a guy who overcame his inner demons. The story of a quiet kid who became a well-respected figure in his community. And the story of someone who never stopped being just a guy from Georgetown.
That story from sound effect contributor Max Wasserman. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Max Wasserman, Adrian Flores, Parker Miles Blom, and Kari Plug. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Make Sound Effect your next podcast obsession. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. Rate and review us while you're there, and send feedback to us directly at soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week with the theme, Cheating Death. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.